I think that's a method that churches use, Nori, because when I was called to be a youth pastor at Trinity Baptist in Santa Monica, they didn't tell me anything about any missions trip. And then like December rolls around and they said, Dave, are you ready for the annual mission trip to Mexico? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And this was like years ago, right? I mean, because I'm trying to think through. I think it was like around 1990. So that's literally a long time ago. And the short-term missions world was still kind of growing up a little bit then. And I said, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. And they said, well, it's okay because you're just going to come and we're going to teach you everything. Okay. And so then I did nothing to prepare or anything like that. And it comes to what back then was Easter week. You now know it is spring break. And the director of Christian Ed comes and he says, Dave, just be here early morning on Saturday. Oh, okay. And bring your truck. Oh, okay. And so I showed up with my empty truck. And a couple hours later, it was filled like gigantically with all this stuff that we were going to need. And the van was full. And we went down there and... it was horrible. It was just absolutely horrible. We had a high school group, and my high school group then, and right now they're having a reunion in Las Vegas, right? But back then, these guys were terrible. They all dressed in black, right? And they carried hardcover briefcases that had all of their cassette tapes of like the hardest core rap stuff that you can imagine, right? I mean, these guys just love Luther Campbell and all these guys, and they're like, this is cool stuff, right? And they were kind of like wannabe gang members in Santa Monica. They weren't really good at it, but that's what they thought. And then we had this college group. And the college group guys came down and they wanted to learn about Jesus. Well, these guys didn't want to do anything like that. They fought the whole week. I mean, literally. I mean, like one guy cracked a bottle and went after another guy with a broken bottle, right? And like the guy who was teaching me everything, he puts a barbecue inside the church and is cooking burgers and there's smoke pouring out. People thought the place was on fire. It was horrible. We were terrible culturally. We were terrible in every way you could imagine. And we get back and I stopped at McDonald's with the group, right? And I got down on my knees and I said, thank you, Jesus, for getting me through this week. And thank you that I never have to go back again. And I called my wife on what was then called, out of a telephone booth because there were no cell phones. And she said, how did it go? I said, oh God, it's the worst week of my life. Right? And now here I am. So, Nori, I feel a little bit of that pain. I've been through that and I know what it is, but I will tell you, I'm kind of in an unenviable position now because I have to follow up on what Nori said, and he took most of my material and time. He took some time too. He had 3 minutes on the paper that they give you ahead of time, and he went way over, but, I was, in a village in Oaxaca, just about 10 miles east of the capital city of that state. Oaxaca is the second poorest state in all of Mexico and has a majority of the poorest cities in the country are part of the state. And we were in a little area called the 12th of May. And we had gone there with my team of interns. I had 8, 9, or 10 kids with me. These were all kind of college kids that were spending a summer with us. And we had been asked by the local church to do a vacation Bible school, okay? And this was right at that time when, like, my brain was thinking, if there's anything worse than a bunch of Americans doing a vacation Bible school, I'm not sure what it is. But thankfully, I had a lot of Spanish speakers with me, and so, you know, it was going to be decent. And so we're in this colonia, and because I had a good team, I really didn't have to do anything. I just, got a chance to walk around. And so this was in 2006. And if you know anything at all about the history of Oaxaca, you would know that in 2006 was the year of the massive teacher uprisings in the state. And here's kind of the setup. Every year in May, school would get out, May and early June, and then the teachers, who were tired of working for a low amount of money, would come to the city square, the Zocalo in Oaxaca City, and they would have a sit-in. For days, maybe, you know, a few hundred of them. And they would occupy the city center, and they would say to the government, we need more money, because all the money came from the government. And the government would say, of course, what? We have no money. They'd say, we need more money. We have no money. And then after a couple of weeks, they'd get like a $20 a month raise. They would go and they could tell all their people, we fought for our rights and our money, and we got that. And the government would say, we held them down to 20 bucks, and everybody would be happy. But in 2006, somebody went off script. And so the teachers come in, and they're doing everything like they're supposed to do, right? I mean, they're reading from their lines and getting it right. But at some point, and this was literally on June 14th, 2006, the government sent troops into the square to clear them out, and police and everything. And they weren't nice. I mean, they just beat these people to a pulp to get them out. And they cleaned the square out. And on January 15th, the square was pristine again. There was nobody out there. It was beautiful. People were walking around celebrating. And on June 16th, 120,000 people marched on the square in the largest uprising the nation had ever seen. And they took over the square. And they took buses, and they flipped them, and they burned them out, and put a ring around the Zocalo, and literally, the government fell for 6 months. And that's what we were in 2006, when I'm out in this other village, right? And we're trying to figure out, like, is it even safe for us to be here? And they're like, Dave, you're outside of the city center. Everything's cool. I mean, one day, I was walking across the square, and I'm talking to my son on my phone, and it's like 6 o'clock at night. So normally the square is full of people. And that's when I realized everybody's closing up their shops. And all of a sudden, I'm the only guy in the whole city center of Oaxaca. And I'm not Mexican. So this is probably not a good place for me to be. And I said, I gotta go. He's like, what's up? I said, Joseph, they're closing everything. And like, I'm the only guy here. And so I, you know, that's what it was like back then. But the teachers, one of the things that they would talk about is how bad the circumstances were in some of the schools in the areas that they were teaching. And so we're out in this colonia, and my team's working, and I'm thinking, well, you know what? I don't have to do much. I'm going to go walk around. And so I started walking and looking, and it's all dirt streets, but I went to the school, and the school rooms, they had one, like, cement school room, you know, for kids to come. But then a lot of them were all tin sides and tin roofs on dirt floors with like crummy wooden tables for desks. And I'm thinking, wow, maybe they're right, right? I mean, but whether they were right or not, it was like, wow, this really is kind of rough stuff. I mean, I'd not seen this. We've been in Oaxaca for 5-6 years. But we, you know, we had kind of a routine that we followed, a route that we were on, and this was a little bit off the beaten track, and all of a sudden we're seeing some different stuff. And then I said, and so I walked a little more. Now I'm looking at the homes with different eyes. And it's like the scales were falling off. And I started to notice that maybe there's 1,000 people that live there, right? But nobody had the full thing for their house, right? I mean, there were houses without roofs. There were other houses that had no electricity. There were other houses that had no running water. There were very few houses that had a roof, electricity, and running water in that area. And so I started thinking about our little vacation Bible school, and I thought, okay, let's say that this is the greatest vacation Bible school in the history of the church. I mean, the very greatest, the one that's going to go down in mission handbooks for years to come, okay? And these 50 kids that are at our VBS, they're all going to get down on their knees, right? And they're going to pray, and they're going to accept Jesus, and they're going to mean it, and they're going to know what it is, right? And they're going to get up, and they're going to be 1,000% transformed kids, and they're going to go home to their parents, right? Because this is where it really gets good. And they're going to say, hey, Mom and Dad, you've got to know this guy, Jesus, that I just met. And their parents are going to say, oh, thank you, Juan, for sharing that. Let's all get down on our knees and pray and accept Jesus into our hearts. And they're all going to be transformed kingdom people. And they're going to go to bed that night. They're going to be so happy. And you know what's going to happen in the morning when they wake up? They're going to wake up, and they're still not going to have any hope for how to put food on their table or how to turn a light on or how to get water. Because we've only dealt with kingdom come and not kingdom now. I left there And I don't know that I was devastated, but I was changed. And then I started reading and thinking, and I came to Acts 17. And this has become such an animating passage for me, and I think we have it up here somewhere, or maybe we're going to get it. We'll find out. But anyways, it's Acts 17, starting in verse 16, and says, while Paul was waiting for them, when he's talking about Timothy and Silas in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. There was a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, and they began to debate with him. Now, these are the guys, right? We would call some of these folks today, these are the smarty pants philosophy guys. These are the geeks that sit there and just have, you know, conferences and stuff over the meaning of a couple of words and things like that, right? But they began to talk with Paul. And some of them said, you know, what is this guy trying to say? Others said, well, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. Right? They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Paul was sharing about who Jesus was, and this was new to them. They'd never heard this. Then he took them, and they brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? So this is the place where like all the guys would gather. Maybe they'd sit on the steps and they'd bring these new ideas and they'd say, well, let's hear them, and then we can kind of consider them and see if we think they're true. Right? I mean, this is that place, right? And they said, you're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we'd like to know what they mean. So Paul stood up at the meeting, and he said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you're very religious. Right? You're very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at the objects, at your objects of worship, I even found an altar. And that altar had this inscription, to an unknown God. So you're ignorant of the very thing that you worship. And that's what I'm going to tell you about today. You're ignorant of that God. You even put on the thing, right? To it, and you don't even know him. And so what Paul was going to be talking about is a God that we can know. A God that's close. A God that can walk with you. The life-changing, the life-saving Jesus. And then he says, the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needs anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man, he made all the nations and that they should inhabit the entire earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. And God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not very far from any of us. And then he says this, he says, for in him, in that God, we live and move and have our being and have our purpose. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. And as I read that, right, I kept looking at it and looking at it and looking at it and trying to understand it. And I come to that last word there, as some of your poets have said. Not only could Paul talk with the smarty pants guys on their level, right? He understood the culture of the area. I mean, like, he knew what their poets were saying. I mean, who are the poets in society, right? The guys writing music, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s here in Southern California, the guys that we would call our poets were folks like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, right? The people that were giving voice to a generation of people. And Paul knew who those people were and quotes them back. That's a level of cult, as David Livermore would say, cultural intelligence that for a lot of us in the church, we don't even think about. But I looked at that and I said, oh man, I've got to do some work. And I've got to do some work when it comes to mission. And that's when we started to think a little bit differently. Because if we can use Paul as a marker or Paul as a model, then we really have to start understanding better the people who we're called to serve. I mean, look, the reality is we'd gotten really good at these VBS type things. We'd been building churches all across Baja California and helping congregations get houses of worship. And we were good at that stuff. But we knew as a board, I mean, even that year as a board with Adventures, we were making a shift in how we were going to be doing ministry. And we had no idea what that was going to mean. And this 2006 summertime in the middle of the teacher strike and everything started to really push us in ways that we had not considered. And so what we had was a ministry that was really good in dealing with people's spiritual health, right? Kingdom come. And we kind of mapped out this three-legged stool missiology of how we would work. And our stool on one of the legs, it was spiritual health. And that leg was unbelievably strong. But then we had a couple other legs, and one of them would be physical health, and the other one would be economic health. And historically in missions folks have worked an awful lot in that area of spiritual health and let these other two legs kind of be really like an eel or something, right? And if you can imagine standing a chair up on one strong leg and two weak ones, man, you've got problems. It's just not going to stand. And so what we decided to do is not to de-emphasize the spiritual health leg, but we needed to get some work in these other ones. And between Adventures and our partners in Oaxaca, primarily through Pastor Chablé, maybe you know him as Pastor Gaspar, we put together this holistic version of a vision of ministry, which really, you know, we came later to find out, right? Like Global Che had this great phrase for it. It's the whole gospel for the whole person. And we didn't come to it through them. We came to it. They came to us, and we're talking back and forth. They say, how did you guys get to this? I said, well, we read the Bible, and we prayed, and we'd made a lot of mistakes, and we learned, and we tried it. And they said, it's good, Dave. It's good. And we knew it was good. And we knew that's the way we had to go. But what that has done is has completely changed our ministry. And so what I want to do here is just take is give you a couple of snapshots of some folks that have been impacted in those different areas. And I have to apologize, right? Okay, I don't have any pictures because like I thought I was going to. And Mitchell said, well, Dave, just send them over. Maybe normally, I don't know, you do some 4:3 type orientation, but we do widescreen, and so could you do, and I'm like, uh-oh, this is a problem, because, you know, every church says, send your PowerPoint stuff, and in Mexico, we're happy to have power, and then we point, right, at stuff. That's Mexican PowerPoint for us in some of our areas, so there's no pictures. I might have a picture in my phone if you want to see it afterwards of something really cool, and it's probably widescreen also, but the first person I want to introduce you to is Kevin. Kevin started coming to our camps, our outreach camps, at Rancho Tunillo with Pastor Gaspar in 2010. Some of you here today know Kevin because you've been with us. And he was there also in 2012, and he's been there every camp we've done. And he was growing spiritually, right? That one leg is, you know, really, really strong with Kevin. And then we added a vocational camp. And he says, well, maybe I want to come to that too. And so he shows up at vocational camp, and we say, well, what do you want to study? He says, I'd like to study photography. And the dude blossomed. And now he's like the photographer in San Baltasar, which is exactly like our model, because we chose to teach photography because we knew that every village needs photographers. Because in Mexico, when a kid is born, you've got to take 5 pictures to put in the frame, and then another one there to have on the house of the newborn baby. And when there's weddings, you've got to have pictures. And when there's funerals, you've got to have pictures. And when there's parties, you've got to have pictures. And so we kept just investing in this group of kids, and out of that comes Kevin. And he's so good, he's getting other gigs around the city professionally. And he's so good that when we do ministry now, we bring him with us and we pay him, because we can save money by not flying photographers with us, but by paying all of that money to Kevin. And if you want to see, I mean, we had our men's ministry a few weeks back, and I don't know if any of you guys are photography people, but the sun was setting over there. And we had this team of men, and Kevin sets his camera up facing the sun. And I'm like, well, this is going to be a disaster. I mean, didn't you learn anything from Joe and the rest of the crew? I mean, you can't put the light on the back of their heads and expect to see it, right? He snapped that picture, and people are looking at it, and they're going, my professionals, they're going, that's the best photo anybody's ever taken. He worked all day to get that shot, to get their faces, and he didn't edit that photo much. He did not edit that photo much. And you can see it. It's on our Facebook page. I mean, it's a spectacular shot. Economic health, and Kevin's leg is starting to really kind of bulk up there for that, because now he has a way that he can make money, and it's even better because he's an artsy guy, kind of guy. And so he loves it. And he travels with us all over the country. We've sent him to museums and stuff like that to help develop this in him, and it's working. But then one of the other legs is physical health, and we had this guy come to us at one of our medical clinics up in El Osochitlan, and your church has, you know, helped when we had just a big disaster up there, and El Osochitlan is one of these cities that we've really been able to see some transformation in, and Evergreen has been part of that. But we're up there for a medical clinic, and Benito comes to the clinic to see us. But you see, most of the people walk in to see us and then sit down and wait their turn and come in. Benito came on a stretcher because he couldn't walk anymore, because it was so painful for him to walk because he had some internal issues that he needed to be dealt with. But he didn't know what they were. All he knew is that he was 50 years old. He couldn't walk because the pain was so bad, and he needed a doctor. So he comes to us, and we're like, oh my gosh, man. I got my Mexican doctors up there, my U.S. doctors, and everybody's like looking at him. They go, well, the dude needs surgery. Well, clearly we're not doing surgery up here on a two-day medical clinic. So what are we going to do? And so we gave him some pain medicine and stuff like that. We sent him home because there was nothing we could do for him there. And then when we came down the mountain, as we're talking, the Mexican doctors, they came to me and they said, Dave, we can get the surgery done at a good price, and we can get this guy to waive this price, and we can get this guy to waive this price. We can't get it down to nothing. So if we can do all of this, can you get the money for it? Well, yeah, I can raise $2,000, $2,500. I mean, that's like 3 phone calls on something like this, maybe 1 phone call, right? And so they said, okay, let us confirm. And they did. And we brought him down in the back of a truck because he had to be on a stretcher, right? And it's a windy road. I mean, Nori's kids didn't make it up there without using those sweet little, like, bags that you would have on an airplane, right? I mean, it's a tough road. So just imagine, right? I mean, this guy's in the back of a truck while this thing's going around like this for 6 hours. So it was not a fun ride. We get him down, but we got the surgery done. And now Benito's back up there working and can feed his family once again. Because a small group of crazy evangelicals decided to say there has to be something about kingdom now. And we made that operation happen. Last April, I was further east of Oaxaca in a village called San Dionisio. And I was there to work alongside a friend of mine who works in the booze industry. He owns a major brand of mezcal, which for those of you that aren't from Oaxaca, you might know that it's like tequila, okay? And I got to know him when they first started their brand, and we've been friends ever since. And he said, Dave, we're going to be planting agaves on the side of the mountain to replenish what people have been taking so that we could make our booze. I said, cool. He says, we want you to come. Okay, I'll be there. And so I'm riding out in a van, one of 2 vans, with about 30 other people with us between them. And they're all from the food and beverage industry here in the U.S., across the country. And everybody's asking everybody, what they do and stuff like that. And of course, you know, it gets to me, oh, Dave, what do you do? And it's like, yeah, I'm a missionary. You do realize, Dave, you're in a van full of people that drink and are going out to a distillery? Yeah. Do you realize that Alberto's one of my best friends and that I've known him longer than any of you guys? You're kind of different, right? So we work out there all day. We plant 400 or 500 different agaves. We come back to the distillery, and Alberto throws a big party for everybody. And yes, there was lots of booze flowing. No, I didn't have one. I had maybe 2. And I'm watching this day go by, and as everybody's having a great time and talking and stuff like that, I'm watching them load forklifts and pallets of Alberto's booze in the back of a semi. And at the end of the day, he brings everybody out front, and he gives everybody a flag for their brand of mezcal and everything, and we have the truck is open, and everybody's looking at it, and he says, does anybody want to share anything here today? And so then everybody that was there with us kind of shared a little bit. Oh, this was such a meaningful time, Alberto. Thank you for the chance to give back. It's, you know, it's great for us to get to know where the product that we sell in the States comes from, and they're all going through. And finally, at the end, Alberto, he says, it's been great to have you guys, but there's one person we haven't heard from today, and that's my pastor, Dave. He'd never said that. And I'm like, oh my gosh. We've jumped from one place to another with Alberto and his crew. We've always been friends, right? Good friends even. But now it's like, he's my pastor, Dave. Okay. So then I shared a little bit, right? Then we closed up the truck, and off it went, $500,000 worth of mezcal to come to the U.S. We never would have got there had we not changed the way we did ministry so that we could focus on all three legs of the stool. This is the kind of unintended consequence of that, you know, for me in my life. I'll be honest with you. There are churches now that won't work with us because of folks like Alberto. But when the earthquake hit a couple years ago in Oaxaca and like the area was devastated, the food and beverage industry, the Mexican food and beverage industry across the United States, they responded. And they responded by holding fundraisers in bars from New York to Portland for Adventures in Life Ministry. And they all knew we're evangelicals. And they're like, yeah, we know it, Dave, but you really care about us. So of course we're gonna help you. These guys give us a lot of money to do stuff like water filters and to sponsor medical clinics and things like this. And you know what? The other side of it is we get a chance to talk about Jesus with people that normally the church would never have any shot at talking to. I was in San Francisco in November for a major mezcal event. Hundreds, they had 380 people at this event, and they asked me to do a workshop on community development. I said, Susan, you know I can't talk into something like this without talking about Jesus. She says, yeah, I know, Dave, but it's okay. We're good with it. And she introduces me as the evangelical minister in San Francisco. And so, you know, we do the whole workshop, and then afterwards, there's three or four or five people are coming up. They're like, Dave, thank you. Do you know how hard it is to work in this industry if you love Jesus? You being here has given us hope. So thank you for coming. And maybe some other people will hear about Jesus because of what you're doing. I'm like, this is fantastic. Spiritual health leg. In places that we didn't really think about or expect. That teacher's strike devastated Oaxaca. It's continue to pay off in really lousy dividends. You have to understand, the teachers union is 93,000 people strong. It's the largest union in the Western United States, 93,000 people in one little state. 10 years after that, 2016, kind of as a look back, I started doing some research, and I put together an article that, honestly, I just shared on my little, you know, small puny blog, and then something unbelievable happened, is that everybody started to read this because apparently I got it right, and like Slate.com picked it up, some other news organizations across the states, and then I started to hear that there's universities in Mexico City teaching what's going on with the teacher strike using my stuff. And I was walking that summer across Oaxaca, and it started to rain, and I had to get into a restaurant. I had to get into somewhere, and so I ducked into this one restaurant, and I'm eating some tacos, and I'm talking with the person who's serving, and then this guy comes out, and he says, are you Dave Miller? Yeah, well, that's my name, right? And I said, yeah, I'm Dave Miller. And he says, the Dave Miller? well, I don't know. I know some other Dave Millers, but I'm not, I mean, I'm one of them, I guess. And he says, did you write the article in the teacher's strike or not? I said, well, yeah, I did. He says, I want you to know something. And I'm thinking, oh man, now he's going to tell me where I blew it. He's speaking English, right? He's completely bilingual. Came out of Indiana. And he said, everybody in the city has been reading that argument, that article, because it's the clearest understanding yet of what the heck is happening here. And for those of us that don't really understand the culture, right? I mean, the guy owns a business. For those of us that don't understand the people here, there's been nothing better for it. When you understand the culture in a way that Paul did, you can go so much deeper into it, and it gives you unbelievable opportunities to serve. I mean, literally, I can walk into any restaurant in that city and talk to owners about who Jesus is. The evangelical church would never have a shot at doing that in Oaxaca. I mean, I can bring pastors and missionaries with me to events that they could only dream of being at because of the work that we did in trying to understand what really matters to people and thinking holistically in ministry. Let me close real quick with one story here. As part of those old ABCLA trips to Kamaloo, where we south of Ensenada, that Nori apparently didn't get to go on, but I know Doug Hubbard and some others did get to go on from the church here. I had to take that truck that I had that was always loaded with tons and tons of stuff down there with all of our gear, and that would mean that we would have to come back up, to head home. And one of the deals about coming back is you had to go through a drug checkpoint. And so when you got to a drug checkpoint in Mexico, basically you pulled up to where the Mexican army was, and you looked around and there were machine guns pointing at you, and a guy would come in with a screwdriver. He would walk along the side of your vehicle and just scratch all your paint, banging on it to make sure that the wheel wells and stuff were hollow. And then he would come up and he would say, where are you going? And I'm thinking, well, because I'm a little sarcastic sometimes, I'm thinking, well, obviously I'm going north. I'm going to Ensenada. That's the next town. Okay. Where are you coming from? I'm coming from Kamaloo. What were you doing down there? Working with a church. You got a lot of stuff in your truck. I said, yeah. Well, one thing that I also had in my truck back in these days, because my radio didn't work, I had, we call it a boom box, right? These are the ones that people used to carry in the movies and stuff like that. But it was like right behind my seats, and there was a guy sitting next to me, and I turned the music down, and he says, you got a lot of stuff in your truck. I said, yeah. He says, that's a pretty nice radio. Yeah. How much is it worth? Well, I paid like 80, 85 bucks for it back then. But I'd used a little bit. I said, maybe it's worth 40 bucks, 400 pesos. It's worth 400 pesos. Huh? You want to sell it? I'm like, no, not really. Huh? But you got a lot of stuff in your truck. Right? I'm not quite understanding what he's saying here, right? I said, yeah. He says, do you want to take it all out? Oh, that's what he's saying. I said, no, I don't want to take it all out. But the radio is 400 pesos, man, 40 bucks. So he yells across, he goes, Jose, the gringo wants 400 pesos for his radio. And Jose says, it's kind of expensive, but it sounds really good. Okay, we'll take it, 400 pesos. I'm thinking, sweet. Okay, I'm going to get out of here. The truck's not being unloaded. I'm getting some money. That's about the best I could do, right? So he pulls out his wallet. He opens it up. He goes, but I don't have any money. Oh, gosh. This is not going to end well. He says, what are we going to do? How about a trade? A trade? Yeah. You want to trade with me? I said, yeah. Jose, he wants to trade with us. What's he want? What do you want? Give me your knife. He wants my knife. It's a good radio. Give him the knife, right? So he bends down and he reaches in And he gives me the knife. I brought it in a bag so people wouldn't think I was some crazed killer, right? But he gives me the Mexican army knife, right? The official thing. It has like compasses and stuff in there and like this thing you can pull out and strangle somebody if you need to. But he gives me the knife, right? And so I'm thinking, this is pretty good. I got the knife. So I give him the radio. Like, this is fantastic. And he takes hold of the radio, and then I hit the eject button because we had some rap CD in there. I think it was T-Bone or something like that. It wasn't even mine. It was a friend of mine. And I go to take it out, and he grabs my wrist, and he says, no, güero. El disco es mío. I'm like, oh, man. Well, if that's the case, dude, then you got to give me your case, too, because I can't be walking around with a knife like this. And he looks at me and he shakes his head and then he unstraps the case and he gives me this and it comes with a little display stand and everything. You can put it on. So you know, in case like you're working at the office, you have this ready. If somebody wants to do something, you can pull it out and kill them and like defend yourself or whatever. Because I mean, like they got all sorts of extra knives and stuff like this in there and tourniquets. So after you stab the guy, you can tourniquet him and save him, I guess. Right. But like he gives me the whole thing. I'm like, for a beat up, you know, boombox, right? So he takes it and he's smiling and stuff like that. And I'm driving away and he's got that thing going. And you know what? I said to my buddy, I said, open the glove box. And he says, why? I said, just open it. And so he opens it and he says, what's this? I said, it's the power cord. Right? He got the gift that's going to keep on giving with batteries that he has to keep buying down there, right? But this is the thing, okay? I'm a Vegas guy. I've lived in Las Vegas since I was 20 years old. And we got a phrase in Vegas, and sometimes you need to go all in. And what that means out there is like, man, you got a good hand, you better put the money on the table. Because you don't want to have four aces and not have any money on the table. You want it all in at that point, right? And so that's what I had to do with this guy. But what I want you to understand is that sometimes you've got to go all in on your faith. Sometimes you've got to go all in on your faith. And what that meant for us is we had to change the way we did missions. We had to change from just focusing on spiritual health to also figuring out this whole thing about physical health and economic health and then put them all together into a holistic model. But like the quote that Nori referenced, sometimes all in means how fast you respond when God calls you. And the reality is a ministry like mine, and look, don't get me wrong, right? We love money because everybody runs on money. I mean, nonprofits have got to have a team of faithful, dedicated givers. And for those of you that have supported Adventures in Life through the years, thank you, thank you, thank you. But you know what's more important? Are the hearts of people that say, I'm willing to go all in, Dave, for Jesus and work in this model. And so when you walk out of here today, stop by and see us. I'll show you that cool picture from Kevin. I even have a full frame wide thing that I can show you of Oaxaca, but it'll be on a very small iPhone screen. But you can imagine if it was up here how big it would be. But stop by and see us. Consider whether you can serve with us, but even if you can't serve with us, take this with you today. Somewhere in your life, you need to be going all in for Jesus. Whether that's here in San Gabriel, in the San Gabriel Valley, and this is where I grew up. I mean, I'll tell you, I know there's tons of ministry that can be done here, but others of you I know are called, some of you to be ends of the earth people, maybe for the entirety of your life, maybe just for a season, but somewhere everybody is called to go all in. Thank you.